Well, good afternoon, Richard.
Good day, Aaron.
Let's start by your giving me your name, and then we'll work into an interview about your involvement with the grain trade, and probably other things as well.
Richard Donald Ross.
And you were born in Port Arthur, I understand,
Right.
but you grew up here in the village of Murillo.
No, in the Baird. It's just about 5 miles, 5 kilometers down the old road.
Okay, towards
The
the
city.
present city of Thunder Bay.
Right.
Right. And was your father doing something at Baird at the time?
Well, my father was farming at the time. He worked with in the bush with a lot of other contractors, but and that was in the off seasons. But most of the time, he was farming, and he did jobber contracting locally for thrashing with a thrashing machine. He used to go around because not everybody could own a thrashing machine, so he'd go in from place to place to thrash the grain for the local farmers. That would be everything, you know. I
Right.
mean, their oats, grain, barley, whatever they had, wheat. That's what he did.
And Baird is where your farm was. You
Yeah.
grew up on a farm.
Right.
Was it a mixed farm?
It was a mixed farm, yeah.
So you had livestock of various.
Livestock, right. Mainly, the last few years of my dad was farming, he was used to make hay locally all over the place. A bale of hay, we cut hay and bale hay, and he would sell it to the pulp companies for their teams of horses in the woods.
So you were using baling equipment, but out there in the woods they were still using horses. Well, of course,
All
this
right,
was
yeah.
through the, as you were born in 1932, so if we fill
In the
it's,
30s and into the 40s, you're
and into the
still using
40s.
horses,
The
yeah.
mechanization in the woods doesn't really get underway. And initially it's chainsaws, I guess,
Yeah.
in the late 40s into the 50s. It's well
Well,
under.
not very few chainsaws. It was all by hand, bucked
Right.
by hand. And horses were the mainstay in the bush. Actually, they started out with just tractors for bringing in the longer sleigh trains to the main loading areas, and the
Sure.
trucks after that.
Caterpillar tractors,
Yes,
I suppose,
tractors
and
and trucks.
yeah, and the with horses out there, they'd be the horses would be fed by with grain, the
Grain
farmers
and
had
hay,
grown as
yeah.
well, the hay and as well as
Hay
the
and
grain.
grain. They needed the hay for the roughage, good grade of hay for the roughage, and they needed the grain for the protein
Sure.
to stabilize the horse, in
And
order to
so
keep the horses going in the winter when it's cold.
what would your father have grown in the way of grain on his own fields?
Wheat, oats, barley, and a mixture of everything, whatever we would need for our own use. We
Yes.
only grew it for our own use. We didn't grow anything for commercial
Right.
use, for
Now,
sale.
did some of the farmers in the area for whom he was doing this job harvesting or the threshing with the threshing
Yeah, well,
machine and crew?
what they would do is they would thrash it all, and if one had extra, they would buy and sell and trade among each other for in order the basic farming in the area was hay was actually the fuel to move around with, and horses was your fuel and your motive power to till the soil and cut firewood and all that kind of stuff. And the rest of the stuff was used for chickens and hogs, you know what I mean, which was the mainstay of the life. And then the horses actually were for potatoes and the root vegetables and stuff like that.
In terms
Most of the
of,
farmers used to have that, their own root cellars and root
sure.
vegetables. They were self-sustaining.
Well, was it actually pretty well entirely
Yeah.
self-sufficient farming
Yeah,
then?
the whole, they were all the total area was all self-sufficient farming.
Was there no cash crop at
No.
all?
Well, there'd be the occasional one, but not too many.
Nothing as a matter of
Not like it
course.
was out in Western Canada.
No. And was dairy farming taking place
Yeah,
as
there are a
well?
lot of dairy farming in there.
Now that
Heavy.
would be a cash crop, I suppose. Milk
No,
for the
that was
city?
an income for the people who had it.
They're selling their milk to the
Selling
dairies.
milk.
There were quite a number of dairies in the area once
Yeah,
upon a
there was
time, weren't they?
Fenton's, and there was one on John Street. I forget the name of it. Wakefield, I think it is.
Right.
And there were
Kellogg?
Kellogg's. Yeah, Kellogg's were in there. Kellogg's was the big commercial one. They had trucks hauling the milk, and even at that time.
into the dairy from the area.
Town, yeah.
So they wouldn't have been bringing milk in from outside the region, I don't suppose, that
no.
this was actually produced here.
Yeah.
So a certain amount of the agricultural product, the grains that were grown here,
went into
these dairy farms to...
And self-sustaining for like I said, that the main thing was transportation and power, mm-hmm. and those things were our horses. In order
yes.
to maintain that transportation and power were horses.
Sure.
I can remember buckboards in the wintertime and in the winter and in the summer to carry the horse-drawn carriages.
Sure.
I can remember my first Model T. My mother broke her arm trying to crank the Model T we had.
Because they could backfire, couldn't
yeah.
they? Yeah, they were tricky. I never worked one,
yeah.
but I've heard about them.
Yeah.
When would you have had that Model T?
That was in the 30s.
Oh, it was as early as that?
30s, about like 34, 35, because
when
we
were just
about
a little guy.
Yeah, I was just a kid, yeah.
Yeah. And your father, was there any tractor?
Yeah, we had a Wallace tractor then, great big Wallace tractor.
Now
it was
that's
probably due to the Massey.
Right. Was that steam or
no, it was gas.
Gas.
Four-cylinder gas, great
oh, yeah.
big chug-a-lug.
Right. Yeah, they used to make the tractors of quite the size. Your father's, the threshing machine was powered by this Wallace tractor,
yeah.
Yeah, the big flywheel and...
Yeah.
Not
like the John Deere. It was. It had a big drive wheel. It was the reason he used it is because it could maintain the belt torque on the thrashing machine.
Right.
That's why he used it.
Sure. Good power to do that.
Yeah, he was a mechanic. That was what he did in his spare time in the bush. He'd do mechanical work in the bush.
Oh, yes. So he'd be away in the winter time.
Yeah.
In the bush camps.
Bush camps, mechanical work, yeah.
Yeah.
He worked with local contractors too, like Erickson. There was a couple local contractors around. He worked with them too.
Sure. And so you grew up on the farm?
Yeah.
Went to school?
In Barrett.
In Barrett?
Yeah.
Right. And you were working on the farm when one of the most exciting things in your life happened.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's really that exciting, but to me it was just another incident that occurred. You know, I mean, one of them.
It helped to be some distance away.
Oh, yeah, that particular thing, yeah.
How far from the waterfront of the elevator were you, would you say?
I'd say about 12 kilometers.
12 kilometers.
12.7 kilometers.
Oh, you've got it measured out.
Yeah, as the crow flies.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
So what you were out...
I was out... my dad had made a pre-cut of a field that was just east of what is now still there, the greenhouse. It's Van Duren's greenhouse now. It's the one for planting trees on the Oliver Road hills. It used to be hills.
Oh, yes.
And we're just on the field south of that. And now there's three houses in there, and the trees are growing up quite high. But at that time, the tree level was fence level because everybody used to cut all the wood out for fuel. And then they'd allow their cattle to go in and pasture, and they used to keep the brush down.
Sure.
And now all this stuff has grown up into first growth trees. It's almost commercial wood already.
Yeah.
Just about.
So it was a clear view you had in August of 1945.
Yeah, I could see as I was making my second run around the field, it was in between the horses, just lined up for a certain area, and I could see the sun shining on the elevator. Sun was shining on the elevator, and I could see the silos,
right.
And the blockhouse above that. And then, do you want me to go on and describe that?
By all means, describe
the
scene that you saw.
What I saw was, first of all, the first thing that I saw was an immense cloud of brown dust flying all out of the elevator and the silo, all around. And then, after that, it became more violent, like straight up. The dust sort of got blown up, and with it, the workhouse went from the silos up and was spinning in the air as it went up. And it must have went up at least about two or three times the height, the thickness of the workhouse. And then from there, in that cloud of dust, it fell back to the ground. And then I heard the noise and felt the noise. I actually heard and felt the noise. So I something disastrous had happened. So what I did was I hocked up the horses and I went to my mother and I told my mother about it. She immediately called a guy by the name of Bisson, who worked, she knew worked at the elevator. She called up Mrs. Bisson, and she said no, he was scheduled to go to work at a later time.
What time of day was this, roughly?
About 11 o'clock in the morning. I'd say about 10, 11. Yeah. Around 10 or 11, just before noon.
Sure.
I would have taken a noon hour break anyway, so I went a little early. Mm-hmm. So I just unhooked the horses, left the thing there, and got on one, and I trotted back to the house. It took me about maybe 20 or 40 minutes, I guess, to get back home. And I told my mother, and then she called. You know what I mean? When she called.
She didn't know anyone else who worked at the elevator.
No, so she just wanted to make sure that she kind of opened. Nobody in locally, that's the only person we know locally who worked at the elevator. And she called.
Now this, you were about 13 at the time, I guess, were you?
Yeah, 12. I was cutting hay in the field about 12 or 13, 12, 13.
Now, I don't suppose you got the chance to go into town to...
No.
Check it out, to look over what it happened.
All I saw was pictures in the paper after.
Right. And
I heard descriptions from other people.
Yes.
That's all I heard about it after. Right.
It's must have been quite the event to be able to... See that at
see
12
that. Yeah, I was wondering what the heck was going on. I heard about the war, and there was always war pictures and damages and stuff like that coming through with what they call a Star Weekly. It had a lot of photographs in that.
Out of Montreal, I think?
No, yeah. Well, Star Weekly was part of, like, an insert in the newspaper.
In the local paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a time, I think, in the farm in Manitoba when I may have seen the Star Weekly, too, growing up on a farm.
They call it the Star Weekly. It was just like Life magazine, picture stories.
Yes.
Photographs, good photographs. And the ones they would allow to come back from the war. You know what I mean? They didn't want it to show too gruesome, detailed, gruesome in case of identification.
Not when it ends up in the living room on the coffee table or whatever as well, for that matter.
Yeah.
Did you have a chance to talk to anyone who had worked at the elevator at the time, or did
I talked to the person who was there working there, Harry Bisson. I talked to him, and he didn't want to talk very much about it. He says, "Well, this is just a big mess." He says the people were out there working at it for 2-3 weeks later, and they were still cleaning up, and they're still looking for remains.
Right, for the bodies and the remains of those who had been killed.
So they didn't want to talk too much about it until they found everything. As much as they could identify.
Yes. Yeah, it was one of the worst disasters, I think, that ever happened on the waterfront as far as the elevators are concerned. There were other explosions,
but not
smaller ones, but not...
There was one after that I was working, I went to work at a place and it burnt all everything around the elevator, all the dust that accumulated. So there must have been a terrific fire, and I don't know if there was an explosion or not, but there was a fire in there anyway.
You just murmured something about working at Manitoba Pool.
Yeah.
How long did you do that?
Well, we were working a dust collection outfit It was a great big, humongous, large tank with a vacuum fan on it, which sucked dust from all parts of the elevator. And after the fan had sucked it in and swung it around, spiraled it around, the dust would settle in this tank after, you know what I mean? That was their way of getting rid of the dust out of the elevators. Yeah. I built two of them, one for two elevators over from Manitoba Pool. Like if you look at the waterfront today, there's about four or five elevators there.
Yes.
The one, first one I worked on was about the second one from the end.
From the north end?
Yeah.
Or south
end? From the south end.
From the south end.
And then the next one I worked on was two up. It was about the second from the north.
In the early 50s, and you were working for what company?
I was working for two companies. One of them was Simon Day, and the other one was Andrews was the boss of that. I just forget the name of the company.
Andrews was the boss of the second company.
Yeah, well, the owner of the second company, I think it was... I just forget the name of the company.
And so these companies were both in construction.
They were sheet metal contractors.
Right.
They worked parts of the elevators all over the place.
You worked in sheet metal work for many years, I guess, did you?
Well, I worked in sheet metal work for about maybe 10 or 12 years, I guess.
Through the 50s?
Yeah, on and off. Mm-hmm. But mostly my main trade was actually boiler making, because I'd worked on the refineries, like storage tanks for refineries. Okay. And refineries themselves.
Sure.
I think the earliest one I worked on was the dismantling of the Hub refinery in Lethbridge.
Oh, so you've worked in the West.
Oh, yeah.
Been away from the city and so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah, I worked on the and the part I don't like about that is at that time, the people in that part of the country that I talked to, you mean to say we're going to get money for this? And they were blowing it off, you know what I mean? And the farmers complained about it because the stuff was hanging around their fields and their cattle.
Sour
they
gas.
Didn't like the smell.
Right.
So then when they took the gas out of the ground, they took the sulfur out of it and then pumped it into lines for natural gas, I think.
Yes.
I'm not sure, but the chemical...
Well, I've seen the yellow sulfur piles lying on the ground at some plants.
I was driving through them in the
70s.
Well, yeah. They were just that's the sulfur they were taking out of the gas.
Yes.
And what I do know is that when you pump gas up, it's just like a fire hose. When it goes uphill, it's fully pressurized. And then in the wintertime, when it gets real cold, a lot of it liquefies. And then when it starts to go downhill, it starts to collapse the pipe. So then when, instead of allowing the pipe to collapse, they got a check valve, which allows air or gas to go in to replace that the quality by the time it gets to us.
Yeah,
sometimes it won't even ignite. The furnaces won't ignite, and that is why, because it's diluted.
I see. Nothing like being a working man on the ground when it's being put in to be suspicious about what could happen.
Yeah, and they haven't looked after all the engineering qualities. Like when it comes to quality control, you have to check at the high points on all the ends.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise customers could be actually deprived of the quality of the gas they're getting.
Right. What training did you have to do this
welding?
This work? You were trained as a welder.
Well, I took an ICS course in welding.
And then International Correspondence School.
Yeah. And then I did. There was nothing there in the Old West where I was working to actually train how to weld under different codes. So I came over here and worked at the shipyard. I got what you call the Inland Shipping Code.
Okay.
It's just like a CWB thing.
Right.
And I got CWDB and I got fired pressure vessel, which is like boilers and stuff like that. And in the meantime, while I was working on the refineries out in Western Canada, I got petroleum engineer their licensing thing on that kind of work. So I was pretty well covered, and then I got a few sheet metal things here with Andrews and with Simon Day.
Yeah.
I was able to do their work to their standards.
Tell me more about the Simon Day and the Andrews work. We'll talk about the port ship a little later, but this first is connected in its way. I mean, here you are controlling dust that had led to that terrific explosion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what the work was. The idea was that idea was to control dust. And there were also environmental problems out east in shoe factories and stuff like that, to make it healthier for the workers there.
Yeah, no, the shoe factories, they'd be cutting leather, wouldn't they?
And grinding the leather.
In the process, they were generating a lot of leather dust. Leather dust, I guess, can be as explosive as grain dust is.
It's explosive, but it's hard on the health because you're sucking into your lungs and those chemicals they used in the stuff. This is what a lot of engineers don't think about, is they have a process, and then, like, even when the last job that I was working on at Avner, it was... what they had was they were having a de-inking process.
At the paper mill.
At the paper mill. They had a de-inking process, and they added that to their sludge. And their sludge, when they took the fluids and chemicals out of the sludge so that they could pipe it to the furnaces so they could burn it, what they were doing is that while they were piping it, they were also piping the gas into the wood room. It was an area where I was working, and you could see sort of where the sunlight was, and that was in the air all the time. It made a constant low-level carbon monoxide poisoning to anybody who worked in that area. And I was complaining about it. It was affecting me, and I complained about it. And Oh, yeah. You know what I mean?
You just endure it.
Yeah. It's part of your job.
So you've become quite a keen observer of occupational health and safety.
I'm watching it. And to me, what they do is they design stuff, but they overlook little things. You know what I mean? It's just like the smoke from a steam engine used to bother some people, but the steam engine was only there for a few minutes and then it went away and the air was clear.
Yes.
But if it's there 24 hours a day, it's serious.
Right. So the system to stay with Simon Day and Mr. Andrews' company for a few minutes, in both of these cases you were building, first of all, the large tanks into which the air was drawn from the elevators.
It's what you call a stabilizing tank. It was a like the air would be drawn in, it was drawn in like a centrifuge, it would go around like a pretty tight bag. Like the air that you were sucking the dust with would go out the middle on a funnel, and all the dust would go into a, like a funnel and then into the big tank.
Right. I see.
It's just like that vacuum cleaner that the guy is making today, that bagless vacuum cleaner. That was the same idea.
Mm-hmm. I see. Was any use made of this dust, or was it just...
Well, they used it for feed pellets. Whatever, if it had any food value, they used it for feed pellets, for hogs and whatever. And then the rest of the stuff went to fuel.
I see. So you could make money from the several parts of the stuff that was being pulled out of the air, which previously had just polluted the air, the air of the city, and affected the health of the men who were working there.
That's right. We did that for two companies. We did that. I don't know who any of the elevators. There's only two elevators that I know there that put up the type of tank.
This was in the 50s already, you don't remember which companies it was actually that... John Andrews.
John Andrews.
And do you remember which grain companies, whose elevators you were doing this for?
One was Manitoba Malting, and the other one was, I don't think it was Saskatchewan Pool. It was, I think it was one of the Saskatchewan Pools.
Now, were the other elevators ignored, or did other companies do other elevators?
Well, the other companies were doing elevators. I saw where they didn't put up all these single big accumulators, we call them, dust accumulators. They had a whole bunch of small ones. You know what I mean?
Right. And this was happening already in the 1950s. The dust problem remained to some extent, though,
but
into the 70s. No, not as bad. Yeah. Do you have any involvement with the later phases when they went to work through the 1970s to really solve the problem completely?
Well, I don't know what the problems of actually the explosion where it started, where the fire started, and it started apparently what they call static electricity with the belts. So they started making grounding of the belts every so many feet.
Oh yes.
If they didn't ground that belt, like because you have dissimilar metals and dissimilar materials. The belt itself would create a static, just like a Van de Graaff generator would create a static charge, and it would let go.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I've seen those sparks let go 15, 20 feet. So that's, you know what I mean? Some guys got whacked in there. They got hit with that.
And the marvel is with the kind of equipment, because these belts have been running for years.
Nobody ever thought about it.
They were just plain lucky that...
Well, any place where you... Those belts where you use transported coal like that, and it was dry, dusty, very minute particles after screening or something, because every one of those belts is like a potential Van de Graaff generator. Like your cement is non-conductive. You mounted most of your rollers on cement,
right?
And sometimes you'd have an interconnecting line. A lot of them had interconnecting lines, like they have. They would run an electrical belt line would be right along the thing and be attached to it, close to it, and would ground them all.
Oh, yeah.
That would work. That was just a happy accident.
Did the ICS courses that you took have any part of them relating to these kinds
of... Well, the ICS courses taught me, like, I didn't go to school enough, you know what I mean? I quit school, started working when my around 15, 16, I was working on my own.
So you had sort of grade 8 or 9 education.
Yeah, yeah. So from there, I came back to my school teacher and I showed her the courses that I had done, you know what I mean? She was a teacher, a registered teacher in there, so she wrote me a regular fluency with that at grade 10 or so.
Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, I just...
Sure. The courses were very much focused on what was needed for
welding. Introduced me to the different types of welding that were involved at the time, the sources of a power for welding, and the electrodes that were used, electrode identification, the gas identification, and the torches.
When did you learn that? When did you take the welding courses?
Well, that was in 1949, 1950.
Oh, yes, I see that early.
Yeah.
I'm smiling partly because my father, who would have loved to be an engineer, but there's a story to why he wasn't. So he farmed in Manitoba. But when he got the chance, in the early 50s, he bought a welder, but an aircraft generator, I think, which Princess Auto and Machine in Winnipeg either purchased from someone else or themselves adapted. Yeah. It was obviously had a power. Hooked it up to an old combine motor, internal combustion engine, and he'd start the thing up and get the power flowing and started. He taught himself to weld through the 50s and got to be very good at it. In fact, in the early 70s, he ran a machine shop in the Carmen area, a welding shop, and did a lot of work until he retired in 75.
Carmen area.
In Carmen, Manitoba.
One of the first jobs I went, when I went across the west, you know, when I was traveling across there, the first place I worked was... was on a farm travel grant, you know what I mean? I got as far as Winnipeg, and then I says, well, how do you find it working here? Well, they said they want all kinds of people out there, so the farming area. So I went into the farming area, they gave me a thing, and it says, you want to go work as a farmhand here, get on this bus, you know what I mean? It was a travel grant.
Oh, yeah.
And away I went. I went from there to a place they call Waskada.
Right.
I worked with places like Joe and Alec, Alex Shellick, and I was out there throwing the stooks. So I had a hard time, like I was young, but they fed me good, and after about 2-3 weeks, I was up to their best that they could get, you know, real healthy guys.
And this was what, in the late 40s?
Yeah, late 40s.
And so you got into grain production.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a thrash machine. They were still all stooks then in this area.
Yeah.
That particular farmer was all stooks. And then... In the same summer, I worked across there. I went from there. I jumped from there, and I went to a place they call Brant, Alberta, by a name. I went with a guy by the name of Brant Parker out of. While I was now, I want to mention this. I don't know if it's coincidence or not, but while I was in this place, Waskada, I voted for a guy by the name of Duff, and I heard that this guy was in there in politics for three sessions. For provincial province, you know what I mean?
Right.
His name was Duff.
His last name was Duff. Well, we'll have to check. Was this in a provincial election?
Provincial election.
Manitoba election.
Yeah. And then the next guy I ran into, I went out to Brant, Alberta, which is just out of High River, and I ran into, while I was in High River, I was working in Brant, I was doing the summer following, the planting, you know what I mean, with the one-way plow. That area, it was all one-way plow.
Yeah.
And with a one-way, like a big disc box.
Yes,
on top.
What size was the one-way?
It was about a 30-footer.
Oh, so it was a disker size, as they called them in later years, with the seed box on top?
Yeah.
So my first memory of a one-way disc was, I think, probably 8 or 9 feet.
Yeah.
Quite a modest thing, but with the discs
he was a 30-foot. We used to use a JD case to pull the thing. And he got out there and he got me. I was first of a summer following with it, which was quite deep. And then when you go to plant grain, you only just touch the surface.
Sure. Just sort of turn the grain over on the seed that's dropping down out of the box.
And you really move that thing. JD Case was a tractor, really had to move. That's a grain trade that worked out there.
Oh, yeah.
Then this guy, Brant, what he did was on Saturday, he says, well, he says, we're caught up. He says, the whole family are going to go to High River for. A day of celebration, the celebration. You know. So we went to High River, and who'd I run into? It was a guy with a drugstore cowboy outfit, and his name was Joe Clark.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Joe Clark, and he was handing out posters, you know,
right. Well, I was wondering when you said High River, whether it was Joe Clark you were building up to.
Yeah.
Good old Joe.
That was Joe Clark. So I met him there. And I said to him, I says, what's going on? He says, he didn't know either. He says, but what I'm worried about is we might be creating unlawful assembly. He says, different, you know what I mean? I'm worried about whether or not they're going to charge me with having for creating an unlawful assembly, because he was handing out these folders, you know.
Yeah, well, it should be all right. This is a fairly young Joe Clark that you're meeting at this point.
Yeah, I was fairly young, because I was still young. I was fairly young myself. I was 15, 16.
Right, yes.
And then after I'd finished that job working for Brant Parker, the farmer, after all finished, well, he says, we're finished for the season. Now, he says, you can do what you want. He says, you can stay here if you want. But he says, well, I said, no. He said, he had an older son who was suffered a polio attack. You know, he was the same age as I was, but he couldn't do anything.
Yes.
And then he had another son, Teddy, and he had another son, another daughter, Arlene, I think it was, and his wife.
Oh, yes. This sounds like the early to mid-50s, or is it?
Yeah, somewhere
around there.
Because
the polio...
No, that was I was in 52, well, I was getting... Around the early 50s.
Yes, because of polio.
Because of 1952, I was working here at the shipyard.
Okay, so
it was after that I took my ICS course.
Right.
And from there, I went to a place in, what the heck was it? I ended up in Kelowna, B.C., and I ran into, so I said, I was out there and just picking apples for the different farmers, you know what I mean?
Right.
I was picking apples and pears, and I worked for one Chinese farmer who had apples and pears, so I worked those. And after I was finished that, I ended up in Kelowna, B.C. And while I was in Kelowna, I walked into a store. I was asking around, where could I find work? And well, he says, you want to do that? He says, go and see that guy who works in that store. And you know who it was? Bennett. So I ran into what they call Bill Bennett. And Bill Bennett sent me to... He says, go to the UIC, you have to, well, the first thing you got to do, he says, what kind of work you been doing? I said, I've been working farm work, picking apples and what have you. He says, the first thing you got to do is get yourself registered in UIC office, because it just didn't start that.
Canada Employment Center.
Yeah, unemployment insurance, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went there and I registered with that, and after that, he was talking to Bennett. Bennett had sent me down, you know, with a piece of paper, and they said, well, okay, he says, you haven't got to send him to the Kelowna Exploration Company. So I went to the Kelowna Exploration Company. I went to a place north of Trail, B.C. And while I were there, there was a guy who was waiting for his, he was a colonel in the Army, he was waiting for his discharge. And I figured it was Payetson, you know, that guy who became the millionaire? I figured it was him, was the boss of that. I'm not absolutely certain.
Right.
But this Payetson... Jim Payetson, just like, it's almost the same spelling as a Patterson over here,
right.
But it's Payetson, P-A-T-T, different spelling.
Okay.
And while I worked there, I want to tell you a little bit about that stuff. That stuff was there. I worked for this guy. They were test drilling across the edge of the mountain. You know what I mean? A bunch of holes. And I looked at the thing, and I looked at him, and I looked at this place where we were drilling, and he says, well, we've been drilling here, and I looked across them, and I says, well, it sure looks like whatever it was that hit here, a meteorite had hit the mountain from the west side and slammed into the ground. So we were drilling up there for reserves, and what we were doing, every 100 feet, he says to me, the way I got hired from the job is a real joke. I went, first of all, I was told to go by bus. I'll go back up a little bit, told to go by bus. To the just a little a bus railroad depot
from Kelowna. Yeah.
And while I was there, the guy says to me, "This is supposed where I was supposed to get hired." So I goes in there and he says, "Well, go in there with the rest of them. There's about 25 other people standing around." And he says, "Okay, stand in a big circle." So we stand, everybody's standing in a circle. He says, "Sam is going to pick." The guy we're going to hire. So Sam, he comes out with a donkey. He says, this is Sam. So, all right. I was a guy, I always used to have carrots in my pocket, you know what I mean? And, of course, Sam goes around, everybody comes up and nuzzles my carrots in my pocket, so I give him a carrot. And he says, the guy says, Peyton says, okay, you're hired. So, fine. Because Sam, like me, that's all he wanted.
Sure.
And he took the first train of donkeys, which was about 100, and I took the second train, which was about maybe 60 donkeys, you know, leading the donkeys, up the side of this mountain. So we went about 7 miles, I guess, from the train depot, 7 or 8 miles. It was an all-day trek. You start in the morning, and about maybe shortly afternoon, you got to your destination. A bunch of tents, World War II tents, you know, peak tents. And a whole bunch of them out there. There was a crew out there working already, but they were all drilling with 1-inch drills, you know what I mean? And the stuff that we were bringing up were cues for larger drills for greater depth.
This was drilling by what means? Compressed air? Or?
No, gas-driven diamond drills.
Okay.
We were taking samples for the ore that they were taking out of there. And so... while he was there, one of the first jobs he gave me, he says, okay, take Sam, and Sam's got a pile of stakes on him painted. He says, go every 100 feet in a straightest line, and you can figure out from here up to that tree, every 100 feet. So I had a 100-foot chain, which I dragged behind me, like it was just a cord with a paper bag on the end that was like a plastic bag. It was quite high. You can see it at 100 feet. So when it got even with the stake, you'd put another stake down, and then you just pull past that stake, go to the next one in a straight line. So every one of those holes they started drilling where I left the stake, they drilled. And then he says, halfway in the middle, he says, is there any place in the middle there where Sam, like, stopped? I says, yeah, I stopped in the middle of that little mound. And he says, there were a few berries there, and he was nibbling at them. And so was I. And he says, well, you go there, and he says, you go perpendicular. He says, east and west. As close as you can to the edge of the mountain. And I didn't want to go too close because the stuff looked like it was a sheer face.
Yeah.
And it was a little split, like it looked like a pyramid type, sure. You know what I mean?
Beware of fallen rock or falling rock.
Yeah, and it was coming down all the time. And on the other side, Andy, I put those stakes in there. We started drilling them. And we were drilling in the summertime, and it started to get cold. And a couple of the guys were drilling with, I guess they were Dukobor boys from around the area.
Yeah, there could be Dukobor boys there.
And they didn't know how to speak English. They'd get a check. They wouldn't even know how to spend, cash a check in order. I had 2 pairs of underwears, you know, I'm used to put on. A dry pair for today. And if I took it off tonight, it got wet. It hung on the thing and it would freeze overnight. And then through the day, it would dry up. And by night, I got in at night, I could get in the dry pair and go to sleep.
Yeah.
And I'd use it the following day. So I had one I recycled with. So one of those guys complained to Pates, and he says, he can't go out, it's too cold. He's too cold, he says. So being an old military guy, you know what I mean, if you saw something around there, and he says, the guy was complaining about too cold, so he gave the other guy my underwear. You know what I mean? I had nothing to change. So I got cheesed off, and I said, the heck with you.
Yeah.
I mean, so then it was payday, you know what I mean? He gives a check at the end of the day. So I got my check, I went down, I said, and I never went back.
Right.
And I worked for what they call Blairmore Ironworks, right. And that's where I took my correspondence course.
Oh, the ICS courses in welding there.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, they did welding there, but I used to go visit people in Lethbridge Liberty Welding Shop.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Where they tore down the refinery. One of the jobs, spare time, tore down the hub refinery and just out of Lethbridge. The firemen, the fire department used to go out there every day when they were running. They used to have an explosion and fire every day.
And these weren't practicing.
You know what I mean? Just
the real thing, eh?
Just what they call make-do stuff, you know what I mean? But they were producing stuff, and they were wasting more stuff than they were producing.
Sounds
so
like
eventually they shut them down.
Yeah. Well, you've had some interesting times. Yeah. 52 is the year in which W.A.C. Bennett led the Social Credit Party to power, and he had the hardware shop in a store in Kelowna, I believe. It. So you met his son Bill, I take it, then, who became the premier in the
probably,
in the 70s.
Yeah. But the guy that was the guy who eventually went into the television moguls and stuff like that, I figure that he was that guy. He made himself a bundle on that.
Right. Okay, well, we'll have to check around for him.
I'm not absolutely certain, far as I know, that there's a connection there.
Yes, and the...
He still owes me a pair of underwear.
Right. Yeah, the... you remember what town this mine operation was close to? You said north of Trail.
Slocan. It was Slocan.
You were up in the Slocan Valley. Well, you had Nicobars around there, all right. I lived in Nelson for 9 years, so this is not exactly my front yard, but I know the territory.
The area I was in where the train depot was a changeover from train to trail donkeys, you know, for these mining companies. Yes. And it was designed for that.
The old Kettle Valley Railway, I think, was it?
I don't know if it's that old.
No.
But
a friend of mine has just written the history of the Kettle Valley Rail summer, so I must take a look at that.
A few summers ago, I went to visit my daughter who was living in BC, and we were flying over. I looked at that hole in the ground, and I said, that's the one that I staked. You know what it was? They were taking out silver, lead, and zinc there with, a Euclid's, how they go round and round, how the iron ore mines look here, just... But this was about 10 times bigger than the iron ore mines.
Right.
And they were taking out silver, lead, and zinc for the last 40 years. And I still think they're taking out.
Is this Princeton? The big mine at Princeton?
It could be. But the thing was that it could have been maybe it was out of Princeton. I don't know exactly. Yeah, the
whole Princeton Highway now is the one that you do, crossing over the mountain. And you run by a big mining location quite close to Princeton. And then, of course, you carry on through into the... towards Trail.
Yeah. The thing that led me to that was I went down, and after I was finished working this guy, so I went back to the city where I paid cash and check. I was looking for a job. I said, I just wonder if I can get a job in the smelter. They said to me, what they advised me was most of the people around there advised me not to work at that. It says, if you go to...
Lots of Italians worked in the lead smelter at Trail, and I'm sure they died early.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another story.
That's what I was told at the time.
Oh, yeah, I don't doubt
it
at all.
And that's why I got on the bus and went to...
Mr. Blaylock, who managed that facility in the interwar years, had a big mansion beyond Nelson. And the papers he left behind were explored by one of my friends who was also at Notre Dame of Nelson in the 70s. And he came upon this letter from Mr. Blaylock saying, you know, what would we do without our Italian workers, you know?
Yeah.
These guys don't go on strike. They work through thick and thin.
Until they die.
Yeah, he didn't comment on that, but they were steady workers.
Yeah.
Well, should we jump back to Port Ship? You were mentioning having worked at the shipyard for a while. You were a welder, and I know that the welders are highly prized at Port Ship. How long were you there?
I was there only 18 months.
18 months.
Enough for me to get my identification as a certain type of welder.
Yeah, the dump terminal, or no, it was already in existence.
Yeah, rebuilding.
Rebuilding it.
Yeah, rebuilding, right. Re-enlarged the size of it.
Yeah.
And then I got a job about with the scrap outfit to dynamite and knock down the big yarder that they had there. It was a 1,200-ton yarder.
Lots of scrap.
Yeah.
How many ships did you work on, to go back to Port Ship for a few moments?
The Port Ship is the Dunn, the White,
A.M. Sir
White,
James Dunn?
Sir James Dunn, the A.M. White. There was another one, I forget. Hull 109, 108, 109, 110, 111, 112.
This is the Hulco fleet. And did you have any particular tasks, any particular part of the ship you worked on?
I worked all parts. I worked in the punch head for the first 6 months because they wouldn't trade anything else. Punch head. Then when I went
what's
out,
what's that?
A punch head was where they made the sections of boat together and they lift them up and then hold it and they weld them together.
Oh, yeah, they were punching the repair pieces of steel in the shop
together.
Right.
And I started out in the punch head, and then from the punch head I went to the punch head to on the upper deck, and I did union out. You know, the heavy plates on the decks, the 3 or 4 inch plates. I did the heavy plates with a union out. With a German guy from Germany. And then I noticed it in the scrapyard, while I was hunting around the scrapyard, I saw the very machines that I used being scrapped.
Now, what did you do up this repairing these?
I didn't repair anything. I worked on the boats, welding the decks and then welding the sections together, and even the overhead plates on the on the bottoms.
It was always a matter of repairing.
No, it wasn't repairing. It was building at that time. It was all building new ships.
Oh, I see.
These were all building new ships.
This was the time when Port Ship was actually involved in ship construction.
Yeah, those hulls that I mentioned are the hull numbers.
Yes. Oh, sorry, you were saying hull, H-U-L-L.
Yeah, the hull numbers were actually 108, 109, 110, 111, right. 112.
I see. And you were involved with the building of all four of them then?
Yeah, all four of them. Their total crew at that time, I guess, was about 28 to 3,800. Welders, about 2,800 welders there. 2,800 welders.
Working at Port Ship?
Yeah.
Brother, I hadn't realized how big an operation it used to be.
Yeah, well, they had a slip. They had the main slip of the water, and then they had one right on top beside it where they could slide the boat in after it's partially completed, slide it into the water slip, and then they would back it out, as they're completed. They just built part of it, enough so it would float, and bang, and then they would build up from there.
Right. And did they build the complete ship up here at the time?
Yeah, everything.
I see.
Started from the hull right to the stack.
Right. Well, I've got some more reading to do, because there is, I think, a history of Port Ship, is there not? A member of the union by that time? Steel workers?
Well, they were...
Or was it...
I can't remember. It was steel or it was some... I can't remember.
Boilermaker?
No. All I know was...
There's
it
the
didn't,
Boilermakers.
No, it wasn't Boilermakers. They had a Boilermakers there, but it was not with the Boilermakers then.
Right.
I was not qualified enough to belong to the Boilermakers in the shipyards.
Oh, really?
Not at that time. Well,
those were the elite workers, were they? Yeah.
I became a Boilermaker after, but then they didn't have any jobs for me.
No. No, that would be the tough thing. Were you doing this work at the time that the Seaway was opened, or?
A Seaway? I never worked on the Seaway.
No, but in terms of the business that the Seaway brought up here, were you affected by the?
No.
No. So you'd gone on to the work at Red Rock and?
Well, I worked mostly in boilers for the pulp paper industry. Places like Espanola, Prince George, Prince Albert, B.C., Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Prince George, right. Lakeview in Toronto. Another one I worked
on
was
the generating plant at Lakeview.
And Courtright, and I worked in a Dow Chemical plant in Sarnia, on their boilers. I worked in also a few chemical industries like carbon black.
So this is the work that you did through your working life then?
Yeah.
You became a boiler maker and worked at?
Boiler maker and sheet metal. Carbon black was all sheet metal work.
Right. And you worked until retirement?
Over here locally at the pulp mill.
At what is now Abitibi Bowwater.
Now Abner, it's
Abitibi Bowwater now, right.
You know, what I've been trying to analyze myself as to why they went down. The reason they went down, like Abner went down, was they had guys, there were 54, 55, 60, and they promoted them to management jobs, say in the woodroom. But these good guys did not have the ability to recognize situational awareness. You know what I mean?
And do expand on that.
Yeah, like one guy got chopped up in wafer board. Another guy got one guy got chopped up in the wafer board plant, and I had to go there after the guy was the management of the Great Lakes went in there with a torch and cut out the material so he take the person out who was cut up, and I had to go back and weld that stuff together. And the fireman, all I can tell how it affected one guy. There was a guy who always, welders went around and do maintenance, there was always a fire guy with a fire hose behind you or extinguisher. And this guy, as soon as he went in there and he could smell the remains of the body in there, he got white as a ghost and he just about barked and he took off. Myself, I went to the door, took 2-3 breaths, put on a paper mask, and I said, well, I guess somebody got to do the job. So I went back and I welded the thing back together so it would start operating. There was another guy, too. The way, where situational awareness is like this. I was asked to do a job with a sheet metal man, and we changed the pitch on a chute from in the bar size the same, but the outlet size, we changed it to steeper.
Sure.
Steeper. Now, what happened was, when it plugged up before, the guys used to go in there and just hang on to the side and jump on the stuff and get the bark to go through. Now, when we changed the pitch, the bark would go through easier. So when the guy jumped on it, he got caught inside there, and nobody else around. He just left there 2-3 hours. He ended up inside the boiler house. Parts of him remained in the boiler house. You know what I mean? And all, the situational awareness is they should have warned those guys on the following shift, all the people that might have something to do with keeping that bark going through, that's just changed. They never did that. They had no situational awareness.
So this means that occupational health and safety just wasn't being provided for properly.
They were doing it as much as they can. They're giving us a lot of talk, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like
yap, hours and hours of talking about safety. But you don't know about it at the time, you know what I mean?
No.
Unless you watch these guys working, how they do their work, you can't. Management
was a
part of situational awareness. Yeah. They didn't have that ability
to
be able to recognize situational awareness. Like the guy with that chute, if they'd have warned the guys ahead of time, that wouldn't have happened.
No, not quite. Yeah, if the way in which the thing works and the stuff moves has changed.
I got slammed myself with a log inside there. And what it was the west deck was a fairly upward deck, and the Huff operator could see the logs going in and see that the pile wasn't too high and that the stuff was moving at the end. It wasn't moving. He'd stop and blow his horn or tap a button, and they'd get the operating crew inside to correct the situation. But on the east deck, it was about 670, almost 600 feet long. So they took some reason or other, the new management in there decided, well, we haven't got deck operators, watchers, you know, operators on this, that, the west deck. Why do we need them on the east? So they took them off. Wood was flying all over the floor, like the wood was being fed into the drum and it wouldn't take anymore. And coming out, it was coming out cord at a time, bunch flying out, and those cord bunches flying out in the end is one of the logs that hit me. And they figured it just hit me through the side of the conveyor belt. That's not what happened. One of the logs went up in the air, hit the side of the chute, and it would look like a kid. The log coming towards me looked like a kid on a skateboard down the edge of that chute, and it hit the edge of the platform that I was with, and the top end of that log just drove me off of the platform I was standing on. There was a guy standing in front of me, guy with a red head and shirt. I give him a push. There was a rail in there. I give him a push against the rail. He got swiped on the back, but I got thrown 20 feet in between a bunch of motors and belts and everything turning, and I suffered a concussion there. And then the worst part about all that was that I went to the hospital because I wasn't bleeding everything all over the place or showing cuts, and they... on the way home, and they said, well, take it easy. You know what I mean? They figured I was drunk. But I wasn't drunk. I was still suffering from concussion.
Sure.
My ligaments were all torn in my neck on one side.
You were driving your vehicle.
Yeah, I was driving home.
Yeah. No one was taking care of you.
No.
Take care of yourself. And that was near the end of your employment?
I never went back after
never
that.
Went back.
I never went back.
That was a damn near thing you weren't killed, if I may
Well, I was
say
lucky
that.
To be alive
yes.
at that time, because I figured if it ripped all my ligaments out, my thyroid went, and then when they tried to fix my thyroid, the doctor dropped the pill on this lip and left this scar. I ended up with cancer on this lip. It took about 3 or 4 months to clear that up.
Yes. And you've been retired since then?
Well, I haven't done anything after that.
No.
The only thing I know when I retired was the company paid me X number of dollars a month, and then the...
This is Avnor.
No, the Avnor, the pension plan, RBX, they paid me so much a month, and then on top of that was the taxes, $13.75. Now, I noticed the last few years, they've been reducing. They still pay me the same amount per month, but they've been reducing the amount of taxes they're paying. And now the tax company is complaining, I have to take money out of the taxes, you know what I mean, the money that I'm getting to pay taxes. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if
yeah.
they can reduce that amount. They've actually reduced that amount of taxes because after a certain period of time, I don't know what the policy is there. But
when I belong
to the union, I ask the union to proofread every word of the contract and every phase of it. You know what I mean? Spend
sure.
money to proofread
yeah.
it.
This is the Boilermakers
Union.
No,
the Canadian Paper Workers. Local 39, I asked them to proofread every word of the contract.
Right.
And that was why these things... because they're skiddling back on the amount. Now what happens, the next stage is, I'm going to say to the automatically reduce the amount I get in pension.
Sure, Sure.
And you know what I mean?
Right.
Whereas before, they're actually paying a certain amount.
Yes.
You see what I mean? How they're doing, they're skating back.
Sure. Yes. Well, this has been a very interesting scan of your life and in all kinds of places and those parts of it that are related to
the
great
thing. Was, I stopped and thought about it after. I ran into a guy, Herb Carroll, here. One of the parts of my job was like this. And there was no work around here, but he says, okay, we can get you a job with your qualification, get a job in Sarnia. That's when I got to work at Cartwright. I went out there. My wife went with me. And they gave me a travel grant. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And so much money each month to help us settle there. You know what I mean? To get settled there.
Right.
Because you had to rent a place to stay, and you had to pay your traveling expenses and all this kind of stuff. That all these places that I worked, I should have been extended. I should have had a good tax lawyer with me to reduce the amount of my travel expenses between, because I was learning all the time too. Right. I went to these jobs in order to extend my experience in that particular line of work.
Right.
You know what I mean? Different standards.
Right.
That was the sole purpose of going, say, from...
When did you retire, if I may ask?
Retired, actually, had to be shortly after that accident. The accident occurred November 27th. I was supposed to legally retire in April of 1997, but this was a year before.
So this is the full 65 years that you were working, not 32, 60,
no,
97.
No, he was 64 at the time.
Yeah, just a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I got slammed with the log.
Yes, of course.
And then I had this angiogram that supposedly gave me a stroke. And the reason I got the angiogram was I'm looking at it later and looking at it, and it works like this. When you have an angiogram, they check your blood. First thing you check the blood, if you have high LLs and high LDLs in the blood, stabilization before and after the procedure. They sent me to Sarnia. They never checked for high LLs or LDLs. They did the angiogram, and as soon as I got back, I had a stroke. Bang. That was on top of the concussion a year earlier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I don't know what I'm left with. What kind of head?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I was asking about the date, just to put it in context in my own mind, because the income tax laws of the country, of course, provided breaks in terms of traveling to a job and so on. You got those, I hope.
No, none. I never got any.
What do you mean? Any tax breaks?
No, I got no tax breaks at all.
You got travel allowance a couple of times.
Just a couple of times with the union. The Boilermakers and the company I worked for, like the only one that paid me travel allowance was Horton Steel of Fort Erie, Howard Pearl. Whenever I got... I left like a Winnipeg and I went to work out east with them right away, travel allowance.
Sure. My understanding was that if you were moving to a job or that there was a...
The union would do some
break, that you could deduct the costs from your income.
Yeah.
But, of course, that'd have to be for each year that you were
doing
it.
Deduct the cost, my income. Whatever I had earned before, a lot of times I quit the Boilermakers and all that. Internationally, because for the simple reason, when I went between jobs and between jobs, I got so broke that I couldn't even get welfare sometimes, because it was hard to even get a welfare.
And your membership in the union would lapse, I suppose, as well, would it?
Yeah. Well, you'd lapse at local.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, because you've got no money to pay anything. You got paid. You can't pay dues. You can't pay for food and for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's grim.
Now, you're not going to...
No question about it.
Pay dues.
Well, I wonder, we have a variety of questions for people who worked in the elevators or whatever. I might take a look at some of these.
I'll see what I can do.
Sure. What would you like people to know about the work you did and the places you worked? Maybe
the places that I worked was, the things that I did was to improve the safety for the employees that were there. That's the thing that I would like.
Yes. Were you on union committees or union management committees for that? Or
no.
It was your own initiative then?
Yeah, own initiative, yeah.
Right. And safety is... it's been emphasized by various people we've interviewed.
Yeah.
The poor guys who do the work become very keenly aware. Yeah. Our first interview was with Roy Lamour, whom you may know from Legion Branch 5 in Port Arthur, and he worked on the railway.
Yeah.
And he had gruesome stories about accidents that happened. And
on the railway,
his memory years later is the importance of safety on the job. And well, you've got the same kind of sense here.
Yeah. Well, I worked on the railroad with, I worked on the railroad too, extra gang. Did it still work?
Yeah.
The extra gang.
Oh, yes.
And when I was working out west in Alberta, around that area, you know what
right.
I mean, Brant Park and that, I took a job at the railway. And we were rebuilding the line between Lethbridge and Edmonton.
Okay.
And we were on extra gang changing the track from a lighter gauge to a heavier
sure.
gauge.
An extra gang would be a group of men hired for this job. They weren't the regular
contract.
Maintenance,
yeah.
right?
Regular contract. And there was about, you know how they have a whole bunch of cars, and that was their bunk houses and their
yep.
tool sheds and everything, their cookhouse and what have you. So while we're working there, the guys would knock over the rail on one side, and I happened to get, my job was to put plugs in the holes and pound them down, you know what I mean, in the old spike holes.
In the tubs.
Yeah, and while they were pushing the rail, the outside rail down over the embankment, I happened to get my foot beside it, and it got my right foot underneath, and it just squished my arch of my foot down to nothing. And so the whole crew got in there when they saw my foot underneath that, about 20 or 30 men that got in there, and I don't know how in the hell they lifted that rail, but they lifted the rail up enough that I could, with bars and stuff like that, there must have been over 200 of them, they lifted the bar up and they got the thing out so I could get my foot out. And half these guys couldn't even speak the English language. They were all extra men, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
They could see the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where extra adrenaline comes in.
Oh, yes, it does indeed. Yeah. Were these Italian workers by any chance, would you say?
No, no, I'd say most of them were Polish.
Polish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Polish, German,
yeah.
Ukrainian.
Displaced
immigrants.
Persons, perhaps,
yeah.
but
yeah.
Immigrants.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all immigrants,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What might surprise, interest people most about the work you did? Close to the grain drain, maybe.
Well, a lot of people...
That dust control equipment, perhaps, or at port ship? Any good, any interesting or surprising things about the work you did?
The work that I did was, everybody figures, watch somebody else doing it, and they figure it's easy, but it isn't. You have to have, you have to know the materials that you're working with. You know
yes.
what I mean? You have to know the metallurgy that's involved, the shrinkage expansion, especially on steels, mild steels,
yeah.
carbon steels, shrinkage and expansion, because the method of welding it is in, if you go by the engineering standards of how it's welded and you follow it, you generally won't run into problems. But
right.
if you follow the engineering standards that are designed for that type of welding, no problem. The end product generally ends up.
And this was the ICS courses were designed to
teach
you those things?
Yeah. They taught me metallurgy of the material and expansion contraction material.
How many different kinds of welding did you actually learn? You were referring to them earlier.
Pipe, pressure vessel.
Unfired pressure vessel, inland
okay.
leak, shipping code, CWB, which is mill writing, like paper mills, you know what I mean, structural. It's actually structural.
What does the CWB stand for? Because if
Canadian Bureau of Standards, CBS.
CBS, because if I'm a farmer
Bureau.
Here, I hear you say
you
Canadian
notice,
Wheat Board, but
yeah,
I know it.
If
it
you
isn't.
Notice on the welding electrodes, they have two numbers. They might have AWS, American Welding Society, which is
right.
the metallurgical number, and then CBS has their own separate number for that.
Right.
Canadian Bureau of Standards has
okay.
its own number. On
what
that.
You might not know is, out of 2,500 people that applied to do a job in Courtright for Ontario Hydro, he was one that they sent that had the paper equipment and everything. And there where they do the pressure vessels, they x-ray every weld. And if you've got a crack in it,
yeah.
you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was thinking pressure vessel. This is really when you've got tanks that are going to hold
material,
air, whatever it is,
or
gases
pressure.
Under pressure.
Just to give you an idea of the size of those things, in Courtright, the main pipe going from the top of the boiler down to the turbines were made in Russia, whereas the hole in the middle was 8 inches, and the outside of the the pipe or barrel, we want to call it, was 24. So you can imagine how thick a wall. It was an 8-inch wall.
Right. Well, that's right.
And you imagine what I was like. And that was just one incident there.
And you were welding these.
Well, I didn't particularly like it.
No.
They got me to fill in, you know what I mean? To fill in when a couple of the guys couldn't make it. I would fill in, but I didn't particularly like it.
You were there 6 months.
They had high-frequency induction generators there that were about the size of this house, or half the size of this house, just to keep those pipes at the proper temperature while it was being welded. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
High-frequency.
Then he was on the pipeline, the dew line.
I was in the dew line. Oh, the dew line. That's really interesting. On the dew line, I was on just below King William Island. And while I was working on that thing, there was a whole, an airport with a bunch of marked out, with a bunch of barrels that were used as flares. Okay. So the airplane lands at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was daylight, it lands. And after we get out, it takes off. And when we go in there, we go into the thing, and there's a hole in the ground. And it goes into a Quonset hut below 12, 15 feet of snow. So we stay in that Quonset hut for about 3 weeks, and 3 weeks later, the snow is gone. There are 4 weeks, and it takes about 5 weeks, the snow is all gone. And then after that, we got no drinking water. And the guys were out there making booze out of the apple juice and stuff that was there, and here I am doing welding, and I have to drink about maybe a gallon or a half a gallon of water a day, and there was nothing that I was doing. And I was dehydrated from lack of water.
Yeah.
And
you're still busy trying to weld as best you can.
Yeah. So I built a tank there. But the idea was that they built a radar tower and a protective hut, and then they built a tank to keep the diesel engine going all winter so the guys wouldn't have to go out and roll barrels in the snow and dump it up to the Quonset hut and pour it into a hole in the ground, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Into a reserve tank for a diesel, because what they had was, they had a diesel motor, diesel-electric motor, and they had electric rads inside, plus the circulation of the water from the radiator was keeping the Quonset hut warm.
And this was one of the just early warning stations that you were involved in completing.
The thing that I noticed there, after the snow melted and I was walking around within a mile of the site, was I found a patch on the ground like this, you know, it looked about the size of a car garage, and I could see a bunch of wood with brass tacks on it and canvas. So I looked at it and I followed around. While I was looking, there was a skull there, a human skull.
Oh, yes.
And I also saw a high heel, like high heel boots with, and I looked at the boots very closely, and there was oak tacks, you know, holding the leather together. And so I said, so I read a little bit about that, and I realized that would belong to the tars. That was English sailors, you know, Franklin expedition. Mm-hmm. They were there. And because they said that on above the hill, the one side, the Eskimos had marked out a thing, and there was it looked like a grave down there, but you could see about a foot below the surface in the summertime. After all the snow was gone, the ground was still that cold. It looked like a block of ice. You could wipe the ice, and you could see a skeleton in there, like a body.
Yes.
And what it was those guys from the Franklin expedition were trying to come down Hudson Bay. Oh. You know, I mean, they wouldn't. They were above the Eskimos.
Too proud to learn the way to survive.
Yeah.
Right. Well, one more.
That's number two.
Credible experience, yes. Yes. Well, I don't know.
My name is still on that tank up there if they haven't ripped it down already. Or my idea is what they've done is to probably use a tractor and tried to move it. And if they did that, they ripped up the bottom.
I see.
Because there's a sump at the bottom that sticks out about a foot, and you can't just drag it on the ground.
No.
You got to jack it up in the air about a foot and put runners underneath it to move it around.
Well, it may still be there, you know, polluting the Arctic, I suppose, or would it not pollute?
My name, I wrote it on the inside ring.
I see.
On the inside, I wrote R.D. My name, R.D. Ross.
Right, right. Well, I think we've probably, from our perspective, you know, Voices of the Grain Trade, I think you've probably given us what you're able to give us, and you've given me, at least. I don't know how my good colleague here, the technical expert, has been enjoying this, but you've tarries and so on and so forth, and getting to know Joe Clark many years later when he was Minister of External Affairs.
I never talked to Joe Clark since then. The only time I ever shook hands with him was was there when he was riding horseback.
All right. Yeah, well, I won't get into telling stories, but
I'll remember very Sam. Eh? I'll remember Sam.
Sam, the donkey. Well, I remember Sam,
Yes.
Well, you have to talk to Pietzen about that. Yeah. He says, do you remember Sam?
Yes.
Ask him about if he ever remembers Sam.
Well, it's been very, very interesting, and I appreciate your letting us into your home this afternoon and giving us particularly that vivid account of the explosion. And then, interestingly enough, your work years later, some years later, in trying to reduce the risk of that at some other elevators.
Oh, yeah. There was quite a bit of work involved in that, trying to avoid.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much again, Richard.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure to have listened to you.
I've always wanted to meet a guy who was a politician anyway. What office are you running, provincial or federal?
I was in the